Welcome to Missing and Not Forgotten, the official podcast of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. I'm Sean Everett, DPAA's Media Relations Chief and your host. Thank you for joining us. This is our second episode talking about Chaplain Emil Capon, a Medal of Honor recipient who died in a POW camp in North Korea during the Korean War. We're going to be talking with Dr. Veronica Keyes. She's been the Korean War Identification Project Lead for the last 3 years. And we're also going to be talking with Kristen Groh, who is taking over the Korean War Identification Project from Veronica here pretty soon. Ladies, welcome. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Dr. Keyes, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. My name is Veronica Keyes. I am currently the Korean War Identification Project Lead, and I have been a forensic anthropologist with the agency for just about 10 years now. I started as an analyst on the Korean War Identification Project, so I've been with this project for quite a while. And my background is in East Asian archaeology and physical anthropology. So I have pretty much been working on identification of Korean War service members, resolving commingled assemblages of skeletal remains, and just, I'm also an archaeologist, so I also do field work for the agency. So that's pretty much what I've been doing here for the past 10 years.
Excellent. That's a lot. And Kristen, what about you? Tell us a little bit, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, my name is Kristen Groh, and I am also a forensic anthropologist with DPAA. I have been with the agency for 6 years. I actually started in 2017 as an intern with DPAA for a couple of months, and then I came back in the spring after my internship as a contractor, and I was a contractor for 4 years and served the Korean War Identification Project as an analyst. And then I took over a different project as a project lead of the Tokyo Prison Fire Project, which is what I'm currently serving. And then I will transition in the beginning of July to the Korean War Identification Project.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, welcome to Korea. I'm sure that we'll be talking to you quite a bit over the next few years about all of the IDs coming out of Korea. So first, before we jump into talking about Chaplain Capon and the Korean War Identification Project and Disinterment Project, tell me a little bit about what forensic anthropologists do at DPAA.
Yes. In the lab, our forensic anthropologists are responsible for the analysis of human remains and material evidence, such as military uniforms, personal effects, and identification tags. This entire procedure is carried out in the blind, meaning anthropologists don't necessarily know the suspected identity or any background information about that particular case, other than maybe some historical background information. And then they complete that analysis. So we use traditional forensic anthropology methods in our laboratory for the formation of what's known as a biological profile. So this includes estimating an individual's biological sex, ancestry, stature, and age, and as well as any other sort of indicators that might have to do with trauma or pathology. And then we'll compare that information to the historical records for our service members as part of that identification process. We also use other methods in our anthropological analysis to assess with commingling, so sorting out remains into discrete individuals and then researching potential casualty matches for those individuals. We use chest radiography and clavicle comparison, and then again, other statistical models that help us deal with those commingling issues. All of that is part of our anthropological analysis.
So you said chest radiograph or clavicle matching. Explain that a little bit for those who may not know what that is.
Yeah, so our laboratory has a testing method where we take remains and chest radiographs of service members when they were inducted into the military. So a lot of them, they were taking chest radiographs to screen for tuberculosis. And so we have a lot of these old X-ray films that we have had digitized. And then we can use those to compare against the X-rays that we have of the remains. So we do those comparisons, and it's kind of like comparing fingerprints in a way. So no one service member's X-ray is going, the X-ray of their bones is going to look like another service member's. So we can do those comparisons and use that in our identification process.
Very cool. It's amazing the different things like that that the body has that are unique to an individual. And you also mentioned commingling. Now, Don Barry had talked about that a little bit in the previous episode, but explain just real quick what commingling is in case somebody missed that episode.
Absolutely. So in some of our cases, we have what's known as commingled human remains, and that is when we have multiple individuals represented in a single assemblage of remains. And so part of our process, especially within the special projects at DPAA, is to assess that commingling and see, okay, do we have one individual represented in this assemblage, or do we have multiple individuals represented in this assemblage? And we have several ways of sort of assessing that. Anthropologists have specialized training in being able to recognize when there are multiple individuals represented by skeletal remains. So do we have duplicated arm bones or leg bones or any other bone in the body? And then from there, we can do other testing methods and go through an entire skeleton that might look like a single individual and say, do these two bones look similar? Can they belong to the same individual? And we can go through and try to articulate joint surfaces to see whether or not those articulations are sound. And then that helps us further say whether or not these remains likely originate from a single individual. And we'll also use DNA analysis. So sometimes maybe the bones are not in the best condition and we're not able to do those traditional anthropological methods. We can go in and sample for DNA or stable isotope analysis to help us say whether or not the remains likely represent a single individual or multiple individuals.
Okay, wow. It's crazy how you all have to go through all that just, and that's just part of making a single ID. So we know that Chaplain Kapan was disinterred from the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific there in Honolulu as part of the Korean War Identification Project and then its sub-project of the Korean War Disinterment Project. So can you tell me about those projects, the KWIP and the KWDP, and how Chaplain Kapan fits into those?
Okay, so the Korean War Identification Project is responsible for all Korean War accounting. So part of that project is the disinterment project that you mentioned, but we also have remains that were turned over from North Korea in various phases over the last 35 years. We had a group of remains that were turned over in the early 90s that were heavily commingled. So they were, like Kristen was saying, they're all the remains of multiple people were combined into a set. So they were actually representing multiple people. And then we had a period of time when we were doing field recoveries in North Korea. So we have remains that DPA teams were recovering and bringing back into the laboratory. And then in the early 2000s, we started disinterring remains of unknowns from the Korean War on a case-by-case basis or a small group basis. So our researchers would look at these, we call them X-files. So there is a set of documentation for each of these unknowns that has information about sometimes where those remains were recovered, what analysis was done, immediately after the Korean War to try to identify them. And those remains were ultimately unidentifiable at the time. And then they were buried in the Punchbowl Cemetery here in Hawaii as unknowns. So through advances in research methodology and scientific methods, we have now been able to make proposals that we are now able to identify these people. So the lab staff works with the historians and researchers in the IP directorate, and we would make a proposal stating how we thought we would be able to identify these people. And those would be approved on a case-by-case basis, and then we would get permission to disinter that particular set of remains. So we were doing that up until about 2017. And in that time frame, we created a proposal to get approval to disinter all of the remaining unknowns. So at that time, the proposal was for 652 sets of remains that were buried as unknowns in the Punchbowl Cemetery. And so we basically created a group proposal for the disinterment of those remaining service members. That was approved in 2018. And so the group disinterment project kind of started in 2018, and it was set up in phases. So we, again, worked with the historians to develop these subgroupings of those individuals within the 652, and we have been disinterring those sets of remains in those phases since 2018. So we started phase one in 2018. We are currently in the midst of disinterring the remains in phase five. So there are a total of seven phases. We've completely disinterred phases one through four. We're working on disinterring phase five, and then we'll have six and seven left to go in the next 2 to 3 years. So we are more than halfway through disinterring those remains. Father Capon's remains at the time, they were buried as unknown remains. They were disinterred and brought into the laboratory during phase two. So that was in 2019 is when that set of remains was disinterred and brought into the laboratory. And we began the analysis on that set of remains that ultimately led to the ID of Father Capon.
Speaking of his ID, what methods were used to get a positive identification on his remains?
Yeah, so as Veronica said, Father Capon's remains were identified from the disinterment from the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, or Punchbowl Cemetery, here in Honolulu. There were many remains that were not identified after the Korean War, and they were buried as unknowns. And over, again, the last 20 to 25 years, we have been in this process of disinterring those remains based on our research and if we think we have an idea of who those remains might belong to. So we get the permission to disinter them from the cemetery and then bring them into our lab, and then they go through this process. For Father Capon's remains, they were disinterred in August of 2019, and they had been buried in Punchbowl Cemetery since 1954, but at that time, no one knew who those remains belonged to. And we did several types of testing, including DNA testing. Father Capon had a family member that had provided a DNA sample, so we were able to test the remains, and he ended up being the only match to those remains. So we had a pretty good lead right from the beginning. We also had dental remains for that particular case, and we compared those records to Father Capon's records and had a possible match there as well. Essentially, there was nothing inconsistent about the remains and Father Capon's records when we did that comparison. And fortunately, we did have an x-ray for Father Capon as well. So we were able to do that chest x-ray comparison that we were talking about earlier. And so this is essentially how we build our case for an ID. We have those multiple independent lines of evidence that are all pointing towards one service member. And in this case, it happened to be all of these lines of evidence were pointing towards being Father Capon. And so then we presented all of that information to our medical examiner. And then that's how we make that identification.
I'm actually going to be talking to Father Capon's family member, Ray Capon, in the next episode. So it's very cool that you mentioned he had been able to give DNA. So once you've gotten all of these lines of evidence together and sent them to the DPA medical examiner, what does that person do?
So our medical examiner here at DPA will look at all of those lines of evidence and make a decision on whether or not it is enough evidence to say that these remains represent this particular service member. And then at that point, we will move forward with having all of the official reports for that particular case finalized. And then we, after the medical examiner signs off on that identification, then that information is provided to the service casualty offices that then reach out to the families and provide them with the news.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And that's kind of where we come in on the, you know, the outreach and communication public affairs side too. We get notified and then we start talking about it with people, sending stuff out to the, so that everybody can know about it. So very cool. It's kind of fun to see how all of these different pieces chain together to get to the end of an ID. So that's one of the cool things about going through this process for the podcast is digging a little deeper. Is there anything about this particular identification that we haven't touched on that you all would like to talk about, or even the Korean War Identification Project or Disinterment Project?
One thing that I was going to mention, and I think this ties into some of the things you were talking about with Dr. Barry. Kristen was talking about the different lines of evidence, and one of the other pieces that kind of provides some corroborating evidence is the biological profile that the anthropologists will establish when they're doing that analysis. And one of the things about Father Capon that kind of set this set of remains apart from a lot of the remains that we see regularly is that he was quite a bit older than a lot of the service members that were serving during the Korean War. So a lot of them are, you know, in their late teens, early 20s, so they're, you know, 18 to 21, but Father Capon was in his 30s. And so when we, when the anthropologist who was creating that biological profile was doing their analysis, there are certain parts of the skeleton that are good indicators of age. We use the pelvis has a lot of good markers to indicate age. And they were able to, and those elements were present in this assemblage. So they were able to look at the pubic symphyses and the morphology of that surface. And we have methods that have established how that changes as people go through their lives. And so they were able to get an age estimate that showed that this individual was in their 30s. So they were out of that 18 to 21 range that we see a lot. So that also for us and this group of people that we're considering really narrows down that list of possible candidates because it's significantly outside of that range. So that was another helpful piece of information that, like Kristen said, all still pointed to it being this person. Everything about that biological profile was consistent with what we knew about Father Capon from his military records.
So our bodies age on the inside as we also age on the outside is what I'm hearing.
Unfortunately, you can't fake it. Your bones will tell on you. It will tell your age.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Veronica, Kristen, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the podcast. And Veronica, good luck in the future as you, I know you're moving on from DPAA. We're definitely sorry to lose you. Hopefully you'll still be able to stay involved in some way.
So,
and Kristen,
I hope so too.
Yeah. And Kristen, welcome to the Korean War Identification Project and, buckle up because, you know, things are only going to get more and more from here.
Trying to ease her into what she's getting herself into, but she's going to be great. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Sean. I really appreciate you. having us on today.
Thanks to the both of you. Before we sign off on this episode, however, I do want to make a bit of a clarification. Earlier, Kristen spoke of using DNA to help identify Father Capon. DNA absolutely played a big role, but DPAA does not do our own DNA analysis. Our DNA partner is the Armed Forces Medical Examiner Systems, Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Our scientists take samples of remains, which are then sent to the experts at AFDIL for DNA processing and analysis. We'll get into the details of that in a couple of episodes when I talk to Dr. Tim McMahon, the Director of DOD DNA Operations. In the meantime, thank you for joining us on this episode of Missing and Not Forgotten. We appreciate you listening and hope you'll join us again in the future as we tell the story of our efforts to fulfill our nation's promise.